The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
It's late September and I really should be back at school.
Music of 1971 today. Good morning, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Jesus Revolution is set in 1971 with all the awful clothes and hairs that that means. And it is really a wonderfully faithful recreation of what happened with the Jesus people in Southern California. And Newport Harbor High School is where they filmed it. I drove past it on Sunday when I went down to St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church. And it's pretty remarkable, Wayback Machine. The Gospel is never way back, though, but it's a very, very good movie. I would encourage you to go see it. We got to come up with America, All the Lonely People at the fourth break. Coming back in the next break, I'm going to play for you Vivek Ramaswamy's interview from yesterday because it created quite a lot of ripples because he didn't know what the nuclear triad is. That's okay. Lots of people don't know the nuclear. I was discussing with somebody yesterday that if you're under 40, you're not going to remember the Cold War very well, if at all. You might have studied it in a book. Now, I don't think that's an excuse not to know the nuclear triad or national defense issues if you're running for president. But Ramaswamy is very humble. He said, I'm learning. I'm doing briefings, etc. And Donald Trump didn't know either, and he was certainly more effective than either Barack Obama and Joe Biden at deterring our enemies from doing things, because under Obama and Biden, Putin invaded Ukraine on both watches, and they kind of didn't know what to do with Trump, so they left him alone. But what Trump overcame by force of will, a 37-year-old running for president will learn. But I'm going to ask Tom Cotton later today about what's wrong with his generation. Now, he's a soldier, and soldier learns nuclear triad, as I thought most people who went to Harvard. But, you know, he wasn't Kirkland House. And to all the Kirkland House people out there, we know you don't learn anything except Mark Zuckerberg, and he left. It wouldn't surprise me if Bill Gates also left from Kirkland House. They're really the dummy house. And the stunning nature of the interview means that we will replay it. Couple of headlines. Russia's new offensive sends conscripts into the teeth of Ukraine's lines. They've lost 100,000 men. It's going to be 200,000 by summer. Ukrainian innovation in a war of attrition. Big new study out from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And I must tell you, it's four pages. I tweeted it out, the link. You want to read it. It's where the war is. Taiwan needs more top guns as chance of conflict with China grows. You see, they got a lot of F-16s in Taiwan, and they got a lot of great jet pilots. They're not as good as ours, but they need more, which means we have to train more. Because you just don't walk right in, sit right down in a cockpit of an F-16 or an F-18 or whatever they're flying. I don't know. I'm not a pilot. I'm not a soldier. I'm not a sailor. I'm not a Marine. I'm not a Coast Guardman. I ain't nothing, but I listen. It takes a long time. I've seen Top Gun, so I guess that makes me an expert. I've seen them both. And I got a fighter pilot in the family. But if Taiwan needs more fighter pilots, we should train them. Another death in Israel. Another terrorist kills another Israeli civilian. The biggest story of the day is Brexit is done. They have done the revise of the Northern Ireland deal between Rishi Sunak and the EU. And all credit to Rishi for getting that done. And Steve Baker, the guy I looked to for Brexit authenticity, said thumbs up. I've tweeted all that out. Rupert Murdoch, in deposition, acknowledged that Fox News host endorsed election fraud falsehoods. That's the headline in the New York Times. I'm not quite sure he did that. He was aware that they were overselling Donald Trump's overselling of election fraud. But the characterization of his deposition, unless I read it, I'm unwilling to accept it. Challenge to student loan cancellation will be argued before the Supreme Court today. You know, all you people out there who are enjoying the holiday from your loan obligations, could you at least give the food for the poor? Paul Niven explains for it. I just tweeted it out. $72 will feed two children for a year. in the poorest parts of Central America. So if you're getting a break from the federal government, could you give $72 of it or more to Food for the Poor? There is a banner at the top of HughHewitt.com. Listen to Paul.
Here in Guatemala, we have visited families that go without the basics of life. We have seen the pain after the pandemic. Things have been opening up, but for many families, it still remains difficult. The work begins in your heart. There's a scripture that says in Galatians 2:10, all they asked was that we remember the poor. We're asking you to remember the poor. Please make a difference right now.
That's Paul Jacobs. I said Paul Niven. I'm sorry. Paul Jacobs. And it's a fine appeal. And it's a wonderful. It's so effective. The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I support Food for the Poor because they get it done. They actually deliver food to the poor. Rice and beans. It's not elaborate, but it gets there. Welcome back, America. That music means David Drucker is in the house from The Dispatch. Follow him on Twitter at David M. Drucker. Vivek Ramaswamy was my guest yesterday, David, and I put him on the air again today. I replayed it. Vivek had a couple of stumbles. Did you by chance hear the interview?
So, Hugh, I was buried in a story that'll post later today. So I did not, and I need to do some catch up. But I understand you asked him some familiar questions, or at least familiar to those of us that were around 7-8 years ago.
Well, Alger Hiss and the Looming Tower are always reliable guesses for my first interview with anyone. But the nuclear triad is going to be, I want to know which one we got to dump because I don't think we can afford all three legs. But we couldn't get there because he didn't know what it was. And so the question is, Drucker, stop Trump. Does it DQ Ramaswamy?
Well, you know, really interesting question there. It didn't stop Trump, but Trump also was viewed much differently. People felt like they knew him. They felt like he was a seasoned businessman and deal maker who could adapt and figure things out. I don't know, and I was talking to Dwayne about this, I don't know if the answer to an 87-year-old president is a 37-year-old president. And the problem with not understanding the breadth of the presidency, if you're trying it at an early age like this, or even at an age like 42, 43, 45, as we've had recently from some presidents, is when you're young, they want to know that you've done your homework. When you're a little bit older and you've been around the block, they may be willing to cut you some slack, figuring if you've gotten this far and been successful, you're easier to adapt and more likely to adapt and figure things out.
Well said. Let me turn to Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, who are the front runners. Conrad, and I'm in Switzerland, as you are. Conrad Black has a column today in the New York Sun saying, never underestimate Donald Trump. Look at what has been thrown at him. Anvils, you know, safes have dropped on his head. And he keeps coming back. What do you make of that?
Well, I agree with him, but I also think it's important not to fight the last war and remember that this is 2023, not 2015. And so Donald Trump's a very different politician and the American electorate views him very differently. I absolutely don't underestimate him. I absolutely consider him the front runner and absolutely believe he can win the nomination. But with the wisdom of hindsight and experience, I also understand that he is a much more known quantity as a politician today than he was 8 years ago. And so he has different challenges to overcome than he did back then. And some of them may be particularly difficult. And if he's running eventually against somebody like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, or even a couple of other Republicans, he's not going to have the luxury of running against a collection of talented Republicans, but Republicans viewed by voters as from the before times, from the Reagan era. And we've heard this song and dance for 40 years, and we need something new and something fresh. And they also have the ability to judge the Trump's presidency, and that will influence how they view him today.
No, I'm in Switzerland, like I said. I'm a big fan of Ronna McDaniel. I'm a big fan of the RNC. Here's their problem. It's not really their problem. It's the voters' problem. According to a very experienced consultant who went off the record with me this weekend for a piece I'm writing for The Post, 20% to 25%, maybe as high as 30%, are only Trump voters. They're not going to show up unless Donald Trump's the nominee. 25 to 30% will of Republican voters. Will never vote for him, according to this consultant. That's a dilemma I have never seen in American politics before. What do you make of it?
It's difficult, and I'm not sure that the party overcomes it in 2024. But there are a lot of things we still don't know, right? We can project through polling and through reporting how voters are looking at the presidential election today, but we don't know how they're going to feel a year from now when they know exactly who their choices are, right? They think Joe Biden's going to be the Democratic nominee. How are they going to feel a year from now if and when he is, or if and when somebody else is? They think their choices are Trump and Ron DeSantis. Let's see if that's who their choices end up being and how they feel about the competition between the two nominees. That makes up so much of how voters make their decisions. But as it begins today, that is a very, I think, true statement. And I think it does present a huge dilemma for the party and one that I don't know can be figured out.
Have you heard other consultants? Because, you know, everyone's got an opinion, right? And at this hour, they don't count. But I think that 25%, right, only 25% never Trump primary voters, not talking heads like you and me, but primary voters, that is insoluble. Have you heard other people make the same estimates of the polarity that the former president causes within only the Republican electorate, not widespread?
Well, I mean, yes, I have, but it's always discussed in different ways, right? We always have this assumption that Donald Trump is going to get anywhere from 25 to 35% of the primary vote, depending on the state and depending on the date, depending on whether it's a caucus or whether it's a traditional primary. Sometimes we think it go down to 20. Sometimes we think it'll go up to 40. Then we talk about whether or not the rest of the candidates are so numerous that they dilute the rest of the vote. Or is it a small enough field that he can be overcome? And then we always talk about, well, what happens if Trump isn't the nominee? Does he decide to tank the person who beat him in the general? We talk
does
about
he
night,
does he put his hands on him or not? David M. Drucker on Twitter. Follow him from the Dispatch. Thank you, David. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside of Studio West, joined by Byron York of the Washington Examiner and of Fox News. Good morning, Byron.
Good morning, Hugh.
All right, Mr. Ramaswamy, you've heard the interview. What do you make of him?
Well, you know, first of all, he sounds like a really interesting and appealing fellow.
Yes.
And you just absolutely butchered his first name over and over and over again. So.
It takes me. I've got audio dyslexia. Yeah. That is not new to, say, Archbishop Chaput. You're easy. Right. Byron York is easy. I wish everyone
would
name Byron.
Well, maybe you change it to Bill or something. But look, one of the things that strikes me is, you know, the U.S. government is the most sprawling, complex bureaucracy in the world.
Yes.
It's very hard. There aren't that many people who have really a good grasp of how the U.S., just the executive branch, how it works. The Pentagon itself is the most sprawling, complex bureaucracy in the world. And I think you could say that one of Donald Trump's great failures, maybe his greatest failure, is that he came into office with a lot of governing instincts that a lot of Americans agreed with. But he didn't try to understand how the U.S. government works and how he could push it in one direction or another, which is particularly important for a Republican because so much of the bureaucracy is going to be opposed to him. And you have to try to reach deep into the bureaucracy. You can't just appoint a cabinet secretary and decide that you've now got the Justice Department going in the direction you want it to go, or any other cabinet department. It's a really big, complex thing. And I do think that Trump's time in office has probably soured some Americans on the idea of a businessman running for president. And this is the only time we ever tried it, somebody with zero government experience. So, you know, the idea of Ramaswamy maybe going to be a governor somewhere or running for some sort of other office before wanting to become president seems to me to be a pretty good idea. But here he is. He's a declared candidate for president.
He has his consultants in Ohio. You heard that. And I guess that works if they're actually familiar with national security issues. I mean, I just don't understand, as many people didn't, not being ready for basic questions.
Well, especially with you, I mean, you're kind of famous for some of these questions. The Alger Hiss question, it was kind of amazing? The answer is really easy. It's yes.
Yes. Yes. Everybody out there, we're giving you the take-home exam. The answer is yes, and we know it for a certain.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, the triad question, you know, I mean, maybe you should call it the nuclear triad at first, because you said, you know, do you know what the triad is? And Trump actually didn't know, you know, how we deliver nuclear weapons or would deliver nuclear weapons in a war, which is, you know, kind of an important thing for the commander-in-chief to know.
No, he bluffed it, though.
He didn't know it either.
Donald Trump bluffed it. And Ramaswamy said, I don't know, which is the preferred approach.
Yeah. Well, he had first thought you meant like Russia, China, and Iran or something
Correct.
Like that by a triad. So, you know, that's just another. But I think that's indicative of just the sort of broader question of having some experience. You know, I mean, Reagan, to go way, way, way back, obviously had served two terms, heading one of, you know, the larger state bureaucracies in the whole country. He's governor of California. I mean, and now, you know, you have as the leading non-Trump candidate in the Republican race, you have DeSantis, who has been a member of the House and is now in his second term as governor of another huge state, Florida. So, I mean, these are...
You remind me of something, Byron. When Ronald Reagan arrives in January of 81, he brings with him Michael Deaver, James Baker, and Ed Meese to the White House, along with Fred Fielding, Dick Houser, and a number of very experienced Washington hands. He puts at Justice William French Smith, his personal lawyer at Gibson Dunn for years, and he puts at Defense Cap Weinberger. And it is a team in place. A member of the Trump advisors who stayed all 4 years, and so that limits it to a very few people, told me they had no idea how to staff the government when they came in. None.
There you go.
At all.
That's what I was starting with. And, you know, part of it is since Trump had just been a political talker, he hadn't actually been run a race or something, he didn't have an army of people who were ready to work for him. If Jeb Bush had been elected president, there was a whole army of Bush fans, retainers, whatever you want to call them, people who had served in the George W. Bush administration. They'd been the deputy undersecretary of something, and they were ready to step up and be the undersecretary of something. They knew how their portion of the U.S. government worked, and they were ready for the job. The same would have been true if Hillary Clinton had been elected. But with Trump, I mean, it was extraordinary, and he did not have people who were experienced in working in the U.S. government or knew a lot about the U.S. government or even knew a lot about electoral politics. I remember being at his victory event in November 2016 in Manhattan, and there were so many people I didn't know. And, I you know, if you cover a lot of Republican politics, you're going to run across.
But he does now.
In the early states. And it was just extraordinary how few people who were in the Republican establishment were around. Now, that's what a lot of voters wanted. I mean, they wanted
Yes.
somebody who was not the product of that. But at the same time, that person had to know how the government worked or be really, really ready to learn, and Trump was not.
You know, you're good. I want people to know he has them now. You're going to get Stephen Miller and others back.
Well, yeah, Stephen Miller is 4 years in the White House.
Right.
That's
He's one of the small group of people that went 4 years. Navarro, Kellyanne Conway, Jared, Ivanka, there are very few people who went 4 years. Byron, I want you to meditate on the Jeb Bush pseudo-endorsement, not pseudo, almost explicit endorsement of
yeah.
Ron DeSantis, because I'm kind of surprised, but W will never make an endorsement because W doesn't. He conducts his post-presidency as his father did, and he will not get involved, period, end of story. Jeb is the closest we'll get to Bush, Inc. blessing someone. What did you think is the significance of that? Were you as surprised? And I admit I was surprised.
Well, I mean, surprised because, wow, this will get Trump will beat the hell out of DeSantis over this. Listen, I think, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot lately, because I think we discussed this a while back. There are some candidates or possible candidates who give you a feeling of throwback to a pre-Trump Republican world, a world of George W. Bush and Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney. And a lot of Trump supporters would just absolutely go ballistic against something like that. But there is some sort of fusion that's going to have to happen if the Republican Party is going to be a governing, a winning governing party. And so you have Ron DeSantis, who's quite Trumpy in a lot of ways, but also did serve in Congress before Trump. I met him at a Club for Growth event before.
Oh, frequent guest on this radio show as a congressman. Yep.
Yeah, and so so he is familiar with that other world of Republican politics as well. And to be president, to have a winning campaign for president, you're going to need to appeal to all of these groups. So listen. Jeb Bush should not have run for president. I mean, his late mother, when she said, you know, the country's had enough Bushes, she was right.
But let's not underestimate, and Byron, I got to say, I admire W immensely, and there are millions of Americans who do, and they like Jeb a lot. However benighted his campaign for president was for a variety of reasons beyond his control, but there are lots of Republicans who admire W. They put him at the top of the list. They put him ahead of Reagan.
Well, they put him ahead of Reagan because Reagan, you know, took office more than 40 years
ago.
I mean, they don't
They don't have any memory of Reagan. They say W was there on 9/11. I love the man. You know, that's what they say.
Well, and so what you have to do is, if you want to unite a party and win the presidency, you have to unite its various factions, and either happily or unhappily, but you have to get them all in the same tent. So the idea that Jeb Bush would support Ron DeSantis strikes me as a good thing and not a bad thing.
In 1978, Richard Nixon told me about the Goldwater people when he was running in 68. You can't win without them, but you can't win with just them. And the same hold true for both the Trump people and the Bush people. It's just a dilemma for the party that Byron York will be solving on a daily basis over at Fox News and the DC Examiner. Thank you, Byron. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Bethany Mandel. Good morning, Bethany. How are you?
I'm good. Thank God. How are you?
I'm great. I want to talk about recess. Now, I am familiar with recess because I have five grandchildren and two of them are in school and they occasionally get recess. And the war against recess has spread far and wide. Would you bring people up to speed on recess and why we need it back?
Yeah. So, you know, kids are not they're not adults. They're not small adults. And so one of the most sort of common punishments for kids when they misbehave in school is no recess for you. But recess is so important to burn off all of that extra energy. Imagine them as like a power plant, and you just have to keep on burning it, or it will blow. You'll have to press that release valve. And there's a lot of research that indicates that people are starting to realize that, oh, maybe play is important. There was a California, or no, it was Texas. I'm sorry. There was a Texas school that experimented in doing 2 or 3 hours of recess a day. And lo and behold, all of the test scores went up.
2 and 3 hours a day? I would have been a four square demon if that had happened. Now, at Blessed Sacrament School in Warren, Ohio, there was actually no playground equipment, a Catholic school. So your playground was a parking lot with four squares painted on it. But you could play, and you could play football later in seventh and eighth grade. But I mean, that was it. That was all you got. And it still mattered. I mean, you made time, you ran around, you tried to talk to girls when you got to the seventh grade, but it was recess, even up to the eighth grade.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you actually, I don't think would have been a demon because you would have burned off all of that demonicity, that demonicness, and you actually probably would have been in good shape. But what's really fun about childhood is you don't need playground equipment. You can just run around and create your own games. My kids have created a new game called I Farted on the Bus. Where we have no bus, just, you know, they're creative little creatures.
Yeah, they
figure it out.
They are. That's why they climb upstairs and give their grandfather heart attacks at the age of 9 months. Bethany, part of the loss of research recess was because of COVID and the awful pictures of children sitting around on. They just moved from the classroom to designated spaces outside. No interaction. Is that what is still holding back the return of recess, the COVID mindset among teachers' unions?
No, I don't think so. I think that COVID was a wonderful excuse for every part of our society to stop doing things they didn't like to do. And so I was just in a hotel room last night, and they've suspended room service for COVID. The doctor's office where I got my last ultrasound no longer allow guests because of COVID. It's like, no, they just don't want guests, and they don't want to provide housekeeping. And this is yet another thing. They don't like overseeing recess. They like it to be a quiet time for them to personally recharge, which I get.
We just lost Bethany there. Okay, you're back.
Yeah.
You see, we're having another one of the drought-stricken California monsoon moments. So I'm always thinking that you're going to be washed away. It is genuinely pouring like Noah's Ark out here. And so the drought will never be over, though, because of the administrative state. Let me conclude by this. Is recess making a big comeback? I asked Generalissimo during the break. Mrs. Generalissimo teaches fifth graders, and she has recess. California might mandate it. What do you know to be the facts about it? Is it coming back?
So I'm not sure that we can extrapolate anything on a federal level because it's happening on a state-to-state basis, but the research is there that recess is extremely important for children's emotional regulation. But, you know, the research is there on so many other things, and people don't do anything with that information.
Has Emily Oster written about it yet?
You know, I don't think she has, and I'm a religious reader of Emily Oster, and I don't think that she has.
The reason I ask that is because the most quietly influential person in America right now is Emily Oster. Do you pronounce it Oster? I don't read Oster. I hear about it from my daughter. I don't have to worry about these rugrats. I get to give them whatever they want and leave, but they're not. I'm not parenting them. So Emily Oster, would you tell people about her?
She's fantastic. I mean, you have a brilliant daughter, and that's why she's reading Emily Oster. But, you know, she's basically the Dr. Spock of our generation. She is whittling through all of the hysteria that is being thrown at us and saying, "Don't stop freaking out, stop freaking out." And she's using the data to convince parents to stop freaking out.
That is so well put. Has anyone else called her the Dr. Spock of our generation?
I think I may have read it somewhere, but I mean, she is.
That, you know, Bethany, that is so well put. And if people don't know about, she's Substack, right?
Yeah, she just had her third anniversary this week, actually.
And she's just now, every young mom in America, I think, is reading Emily Oster. Oster?
I don't know. I wish I had an answer on that question.
Okay, well, this is my weekly segment with Bethany, and by next week we'll figure out how to pronounce Emily Oster. Bethany Mandel, follow her on Twitter at Bethany Shondark. Read her columns in Deseret News and their syndication, and keep coming back. Bethany, always good to see you.
Look, you did the tough thing during COVID. You paid your people and pulled your business through the pandemic, or really the lockdown. And now, doing the tough thing could qualify you for up to $26,000 per employee at COVIDtaxrelief.org. Government funds are available to reward companies with two or more employees who stayed open during COVID. This is not a loan, and you don't have to pay it back. The program is complicated, but nobody knows more about it than the CPAs and tax experts at COVIDtaxrelief.org. You pay nothing up front. They do all the work and share a percentage of the cash they get you. Businesses of all types, including nonprofits and churches, can qualify, including those who took PPP loans, even if you had increases in sales. You did the tough thing for your employees during COVID. Let COVIDtaxrelief.org help you get up to $26,000 per employee. Visit COVIDtaxrelief.org. That's COVIDtaxrelief.org.
On Tuesdays when we are lucky, Molly Hemingway joins us with a full voice. She joins us this morning, but she's got a touch of laryngitis. And Molly, I'm sympathetic. I've had to go through entire three-hour shows and 6 hours or weeks with laryngitis, and it's not fun, but thank you for persevering and joining me.
Doing my best.
Oh, you're doing very good. Molly, I want to run a theory past you. You're young. I don't know if you have any actual memories of Reagan or HW, but maybe you do. Nevertheless, I had Mr. Ramaswamy on yesterday, and he's younger than you are. And he didn't know what the nuclear triad was. So I began talking to my wife about this. And I have a general theory that unless you've actually plunged into politics and you're born after the collapse of the Soviet Union or were young when it happened, you don't really know a lot about national security from superpower competition days because it hadn't existed since then. What do you make of my theory?
I think it might be true. I mean, I am old enough to remember much of the Cold War, you know, the portion of the Cold War that I was under, and the threat of nuclear annihilation and how, you know, we were school children who were being prepared for possible nuclear strikes. And so we learned a lot about, you know, defense and what our strategic position was. And also, you know, during the 80s, what Reagan was doing with even SDI was such a big thing that I don't even hear people talk about that anymore either.
No, I didn't ask Mr. Ramaswamy about that because that's a trick question. I just kind of view the triad, and I have to stop doing this. I just thought, you know, ask him about the triad because I don't think we can afford three legs of the triad anymore. So my follow-up was going to be, which one do you eliminate? And we didn't get there because he didn't know what the concept was. Now, that happened to President Trump, too, but that's very different. Donald Trump was purposefully not in the weeds. Ramaswamy is a brilliant pharmaceutical, big innovator, Harvard guy. And I'm just kind of surprised. But then I put it down, talking to my wife about it, that it might be a generational thing.
Well, you know, you mentioned Trump, but he was inarguably our best foreign policy president in recent memory.
Yes.
You know, handled so many things without getting us into conflict. And so, you know, it yet didn't always do great with the really, you know, particular questions on what something was.
Oh, he didn't know who Soleimani was, but he killed him.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what I tell people is, you know, I asked him about Soleimani and he didn't know who it was and the Kurds and the Kuds. But when it came to be crunch time and he was going to Iraq to kill Americans, Trump ordered him taken out. And that. Go ahead.
I also think it shows how really strong national defense policy isn't necessarily interventionist. He did take out bad guys when they needed to be taken out. He was very strong, in fact, but he didn't want to necessarily do this thing that we've been doing in recent decades, getting involved in a war without a clear strategy, without a good end game, without knowing like what the result is going to be. And I think that's why it was so popular with the American people, too.
You know, Molly, the popular history is that President Trump ordered a strike on Assad in the early days of the Syrian genocide when he saw pictures of babies being gassed, and that then Secretary of Defense General Mattis countermanded it. You're familiar with that narrative?
Yeah, I remember the reporting.
I don't know if it's true, but let's assume it is and not treat it as a counterfactual. Wouldn't it have been better to have killed Assad? I mean, the man is a maniac. He's still a maniac, and now he's threatening Israel by allowing the transshipment of everything from Iran to Hezbollah.
In general, the U.S. has had this problem of thinking that bad guys should be taken out without realizing that they're frequently replaced by even worse guys. Our policy of regime change has just frequently not worked very well. And it's because we don't understand that sometimes the underlying conditions in a country that are producing action from a country that we don't like. It's not just like one bad guy. And getting even more deeply mired into Mideast wars when we really need to be pivoting to China would actually not be a great idea. And so while it is important to take out really bad guys like Soleimani, you don't want to deviate from your actual foreign policy focus, which should be laser focused on your national interest and what actually threatens the American people.
Well, if Trump had his wish carried out, that would have restored the red line doctrine in America that Obama erased. We'll discuss that another time. Molly, the senior strategist I talked with on the weekend said about Donald Trump and the Republican primary electorate that 20 to 35, 25% to 30% are only Trump voters. and the same number are never Trump voters. And by never Trump, I don't mean the talking heads who are paid to be anti-Trump on every appearance that they ever make. I mean the people in the Republican Party who won't vote for him. That's, to me, an almost insoluble dilemma, isn't it?
It's a huge challenge for the other candidates to figure out how they can beat Trump without alienating that third that you're talking about in these polls. And it might not be able to be done, but
might not be possible. Yep.
It's definitely something they need to work on.
Well, how do you think it's done? What ideas would you give to the 10 other people? And I think there are probably a total of 9 other serious candidates who will be on the stage and will be debating Trump. What do you suggest they do?
Well, I actually think that the thing that's really interesting about Trump is that his policies are so popular. And also his attitude toward enemies of the Republican Party is very popular. So I think emulating those really good traits, you know, if you're not Trump, emulating those really good traits of Trump can be a really good way to win over his voters. And I noticed how Glenn Youngkin did it when he was running for office. I mean, he's not like the ideal candidate or anything like that. But he did a really good job of not being Trumpy without in any way alienating the Trump voters. And he rode that coalition to victory in Virginia.
He was also assisted by the former president in the right way. Phone calls to supporters of Trump. So Trump called the 25 to 30% who were only Trumpers and helped Glenn Youngkin win. Molly Hemingway, I want to ask you very quickly about the administrative state. Ron DeSantis has been talking about it. I think every candidate will. The administrative state has kind of surfaced as a real, it's not the deep state, it's just the ubiquitous, ever-present government that never calls off a crisis that it benefits by. And I'm talking about it because I went on a little rant on Twitter about the drought never being over in California, though we are drowning out here. Do you think the idea of an ominous growth in the administrative state resonates with regular voters?
Well, I don't know how well they understand the term, but everyone has felt, and we were talking about Reagan, going back to Reagan, how the bureaucracy is sort of at war with the American people frequently, how they serve as judge, jury, and executioner with small businesses or with family decisions. And I think that that is a salient political point that all Republicans should be moving forward. It's a really violation of our Constitution, how much power these bureaucrats have over and against the American people versus what, you know, how our Constitution arranged it, where we would all get a say in how we're governed.
Now, Molly, I want to end by the Supreme Court today will take up Joe Biden's unconstitutional attempt to forgive student loans. And I am very, very confident it will be struck down. I want them to do it in like a day so that everybody understands what he did is so fundamentally wrong. Are you as optimistic as I am?
I don't know. I hope so. And I noticed that nobody seems to think that Biden has the better of the legal arguments because of the way they're talking about it. Nobody's putting forth legal arguments that seem like they will hold sway. So you're probably right to be optimistic.
But will they act? I mean, this has got to stop. Talk about the administrative state. The executive cannot do things like this. And Joe Biden got away. It probably got him a better result in November than otherwise he would have had.
I think they were kind of open that they were doing this for political gain, even though they knew that it was not constitutional. Not the first president to do something like this, but it's really despicable.
Despicable. Molly, I'll let you go. MZ Hemingway on Twitter. Good luck with The Voice. It is a bane of broadcasters everywhere. There are secret sauces, which I'll tell you about a little bit later. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Time to talk about the Wuhan lab leak and reprising the role of Senator Tom Cotton in January of 2020. Is Senator Tom Cotton? He's back saying the same thing he said 2.5 years ago. Senator Cotton, good morning. How's it feel to be absolutely right and have to have Democrats admit it to you?
Well, Hugh, I knew I was right all along, as in most normal Americans who just looked at the facts in front of their face and used their common sense that this virus almost certainly came from those labs in Wuhan. You won't be surprised here. I haven't heard many Democrats come up to me in the Senate yet to apologize for saying I and so many Americans were spreading fringe conspiracy theories or we were racist or nativist or xenophobic. Unfortunately, you know, I don't see many actions from the Biden administration or the Democrats either on trying to make China pay for its wrongdoing. That's really the most important thing. It's not that I was right 3 years ago. It's that I remain right about trying to force China to pay for the millions of lives lost, to this virus, the businesses that were destroyed, the jobs that were lost as well, by doing things like revoking its most favored nation trading status, banning Communist Party aligned Chinese nationals from buying our farmland, banning TikTok from our country, and many steps, other steps that are long overdue.
Let me play for you Stephen Colbert last night on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert talking about the Department of Energy study, that intelligence report that matches up with the FBI conclusion that the Wuhan lab is where the virus came from. Here is Colbert last night.
But Tom, if you're watching, thank you. Talk to me, Goose. Now, here's another surprising development this weekend. The Department of Energy released a new report saying a lab leak is the most likely origin of the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, there it is. Chinese wet markets, you're off the hook. Let's order a round of pangolin poppers for the table. I love a nice plate of wet apps. Now, can we get some civet fingers, please? Now, if, like me, you're wondering why the Department of Energy is the one making this judgment, it's because that agency oversees a network of U.S. national laboratories, some of which conduct advanced biological research. No, no. Bad energy department. No bio labs until you finish building your electric car charging stations. Stay in your lane. You don't see the Census Bureau building nukes. But whatever. Who am I to say? They're the energy department. I'm sure they're smart. They wouldn't release these findings unless they were absolutely confident. What's that? They made their judgment with low confidence.
All right, Senator Cotton, you get it, right? What media is doing now is attacking the finding.
Yeah, well, from that clip, you can conclude why I and almost every other American don't watch that show, because it's not that funny. And I say that it's no laughing matter, you know, if you lost your grandmother and didn't have a chance to visit her as she was passing away in the hospital and didn't have a chance to have a funeral service for us. No laughing matter if Tony Fauci shut down your business and cost you your job, all of the result of Chinese wrongdoing and duplicity from the very beginning that made this pandemic worse and the effects of it longer than it had to be. So people like Stephen Colbert and The Washington Post and The New York Times and Tony Fauci can try to sweep this all under the rug or make light of it now. But there were severe harms inflicted on the American people. And it's just a reminder of how the left in America, whether it's in media or supposed comedy shows or the White House or social media, tries to suppress honest debate about genuine questions of public concern. Remember, people who said, like, well, gosh, maybe we should study the lab that's right down the street from this so-called food market that doesn't have any bats present. Where in the lab, they do have bats. They study coronaviruses. Everybody knows that Chinese labs are very unsound. If you said that, you were accused of spreading fringe conspiracy theories, and you were suppressed on social media accounts, and the media came down on you like a ton of bricks. That's not the way to get to the truth in public debates. It's not the way to make sound public policy. And those same people are doing the exact same things today on a number of issues.
Your colleague, Senator Cruz, has said we've really got to have hearings on everything that went wrong during COVID. But Hewitt's law holds, and this applies to California's drought. It applies to lockdown decisions. Hewitt law is that no administrative agency declares a problem, much less a crisis, solved when such declaration will reduce its authority, budget, or profile. I don't think we'll ever get CDC, NIH, Tony Fauci, anybody to admit they were completely wrong on anything, Senator Cotton. I have no hope of that ever happening. Do you?
Not really, Hugh. I mean, if you look at Tony Fauci's very rigid ideological pronouncements, and in retrospect, even when they do say that something didn't have much effect, like mask wearing, you know, even when you're outdoors the vaccines that we all hoped would be more effective than they were, but turned out not to be as effective for stopping the spread of the virus as opposed to, say, minimizing its harms on those who are most susceptible to it. They still say that they were right at the time. They were just, quote-unquote, following the science, when in reality they were following your iron law, which is taking actions that aggrandize their own power, gave them more control, and gave them more budgets. You know, I'm reminded of what Kevin Hazlitt, who was on President Trump's economic team, said about an early meeting in the White House whenever he was portraying the data about how Tony Fauci's desired endless shutdowns and lockdowns could have such a devastating impact on our economy. And Tony Fauci jumped in and said, I'm still in charge, right? That's what it was ultimately about.
The funny thing about it is, and it's not funny, nuance has become impossible. And you just gave a very nuanced answer. I am double vaxxed and I get my boosters because I'm over 65 and it works for seniors. And if we had limited to that, protect the vulnerable, and that would be seniors and people with underlying conditions, it would have been fine. But I'm very sympathetic to people who made early mistakes. So you got to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And they did, but they didn't react, Senator Cotton. They did not change their point of view on anything. Masks, lockdown. Go ahead.
No, they still haven't. And then you see it around the nation's capital. You still have people wearing masks, like when they're walking down the streets or when they're riding a car by themselves. For many of these liberals, it's become a kind of political identity. But I do want to stress again just how much harm China inflicted on the civilized world. It's hard to imagine this kind of virus breaking out from, say, I don't know, Denmark or the Netherlands because they have much higher safety standards. But let's say it did happen in that kind of country, friendly, democratic, capitalist country, and they had immediately been transparent about what had happened, as early as, late November of 2019. By the time that virus got to our shores in large numbers, in February or March of 2020, we could have already realized that it was most dangerous for people who were elderly and infirm. We might have avoided the extended lockdowns. And like you, Hugh, I don't fault President Trump or any governor or other executive official at any level for taking early precautions against this virus when we didn't know what its reproduction rate was going to be. We didn't know how deadly it was going to be for the general population. But as we quickly learned in March and into April that it was mostly dangerous for the elderly and infirm, we should have taken very rapid action to try to get back to normal as quickly as we could. If China had been transparent from the very beginning, we might have known all that before it arrived on our shores in large numbers and have avoided the worst of the economic losses, the worst of the educational losses for our kids. That's why China still has a lot to answer for, and I just don't see the commitment from the Biden administration in making it answer.
There is a naivete, Senator Cotton, among younger people, not you, but among younger people generally, about what communist regimes are capable of. Now, Gary Oldman in the new series on Apple, Slow Horses, is confusing the daylights out of people because they don't understand what the KGB was. But if they did, they would understand that the communist parties of both countries are capable of anything. And I still believe, and I talked about it with your friend Mike Pompeo yesterday, the possibility that China, having realized what it had done to itself with this virus, just decided that the rest of the world would have to suffer the same consequences so they would not fall behind. And Secretary Pompeo, of course, said, well, we don't have any proof of that, and we never will. But it is plausible if you understand communist regimes. Agree or disagree?
No, I wouldn't say it's plausible, Hugh. It's probable that China understood what this virus could do, and they kept it from the world. They didn't stop travel out of Wuhan to the rest of the world. If they were going to suffer significant numbers of deaths, and certainly if they were going to suffer the kind of economic harms this virus inflicted on Wuhan from the very beginning, when they were locking down entire populations larger than the state of California in January of 2020, and they were going to take the rest of the world along with them on the ride. That's what communists do. And you're right that young people today should have mandatory courses where they have to read things like 1984 and Darkness at Noon and study the history of Soviet Russia or Mao's crimes against his own people so they understand what communists are capable of.
That's what communists do. I don't know that I've heard anyone in legacy media make that statement in a long time, Senator Cotton. It's as though it's erased from their memory banks how communists act. And Xi is a communist. He's a survivor. He's a ruthless guy. And I don't think the world gets it.
Well, it's not just in liberal media. I mean, it's in a lot of think tanks and positions of power in Washington and the government and in Congress who still are operating under this delusion that China and Xi Jinping in particular somehow wants to move them towards a market-based economy and will ultimately open up further. That's never been the case. It was a mistaken premise for 30 years, but especially for the last 10 years since Xi Jinping took power. He is clearly a Marxist-Leninist in the classic sense. He puts the party above all else, above the nation, above the government, certainly above the people. And he simply wants to harness some of the tools and instruments of markets to further the party's power and to cement its control over its own people and ultimately its ascendancy in the world.
Senator Cotton, thank you. And unless until people remember that, they're never going to understand the China challenge. I appreciate your joining me, Senator Cotton. And I'd like to take credit for you saying about the Wuhan lab leak that first here, but I think maybe Maria Bartiromo beat me. I don't know. I have to go back and listen to the tapes, but I'm very glad you're still there and that you are vindicated again, even though Stephen Colbert will not admit it. Senator Tom Cotton, thank you.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.